Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we are going to talk about the Iranian military and the various branches that the military has, as well as some of the involvement that is going on with foreign entities. And today I'm very happy to introduce a new guest on the Loopcast, Dr. Michael Connell, and he is a Middle East specialist and the director of CNA's Iranian Studies Program. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Connell.
It's my pleasure, Chelsea. Happy to be here.
And a little bit of his background. As I mentioned, he's the director of CNA's Iranian Studies Program, and he earned his PhD in History and Middle Eastern Studies from Harvard University, and he has a BA in Near and Middle Eastern Studies from Brandeis University. And he also has a certificate in Persian Studies from Tehran University, which off the show, I'd love to hear more about that because that sounds like a fascinating experience.
Different stage of my life, but happy to talk about it.
Yes, I mean, not many people can say that they have spent time in Iran, especially as a U.S. citizen or someone that's lived in the U.S. for a while. So I'm jealous because I'd love to visit sometime.
It's a beautiful country if you ever get the chance to go.
I will put that on my list, my bucket list, so to speak. And for our listeners, a little background on CNA. CNA is not an acronym, is correctly referenced as CNA, and it's a nonprofit research and analysis organization, which is located in Arlington, Virginia. And those who have listened to the Loopcast know that we've had a number of CNA experts, as well as some of the papers that the organization has put out, and we've discussed them. So it's always great having a new member of CNA. Well, not a new member in the sense of new at the corporation, but a new member to the Loopcast, should I say. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Connell.
My pleasure.
So to start off with this interesting topic, why don't you give our listeners an overview of the varying branches of the Iranian military?
Sure. Well, Iran's fairly unique. Unlike many other countries, developing or developed, Iran has two parallel military services: the regular military, colloquially known as the Artesh, and the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's fairly unique in this regard. So Iran essentially has two air forces, two ground forces, two navies, and also the IRGC has some additional branches. It has the Quds Force, which oversees Iran's relationship with proxy forces around the region. And then it also has the Basij, which is a popular mobilization force. These two forces are very different. The regular military is a lot like a military in the Western sense. They have military academies, they learn Western-style military sciences, and they fight like a traditional military. The IRGC grew out of the various militias and armed factions which supported Khomeini during the revolution, and they certainly have retained some of their revolutionary roots. Think of them as for their ground forces, it's sort of like a guerrilla force on land. For the naval forces, I tend to refer to them as a guerrilla force at sea. They use asymmetric tactics. They tend to use low-tech means to compete with high-tech adversaries. Very different force. They also have different mission sets. So the Artesh is viewed as a traditional military in the sense that it's there to protect the country, the nation of Iran. The IRGC's core function is really to defend the revolution, to defend the Islamic Republic, which has a slightly different connotation than defending the nation state. So the two militaries do have parallel functions. They overlap in some cases. They do have a Armed Forces General Staff, which oversees the entire military. It's a lot like the U.S. Joint Staff in the sense that the chain of command for the two services is united at that level. They have a Ministry of Defense, but the Ministry of Defense doesn't really have much of a military role aside from what colloquially we refer to in the West as the man, train, and equip function. But it doesn't really engage in operational planning or major operations on the ground. And finally, the point I would add, too, is that the head of the armed forces in Iran isn't the president. This is a misconception that a lot of people have. It's the supreme leader. So he's the one who's in charge of Iran's armed forces. They don't report to the president. They report to the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei.
So you have sets of the military that it sounds like most of them are in twos. So you have two of this and two of that. And how does this all work together as a cohesive force? Or is that not something that is actually happening?
It's a good question. To sum up, I'd say not very well. because there are overlapping functions and missions, and they operate oftentimes in the same geographic space, they do have coordination problems. This isn't unique to Iran. I mean, a lot of armed forces around the world, getting just navies and air forces to work together can be a very difficult process. But the fact that they have these two parallel services operating alongside each other can pose unique problems in the Iranian case. These problems were first noticed during the Iran-Iraq War, where there was a lot of inter-service rivalry. To a certain extent, Iran's armed forces, the military officials are aware of this, and they've been working on developing a more cohesive approach to operations. They've been conducting joint exercises. They established a joint staff. There wasn't a joint staff through the Iran-Iraq War. It only was established after the war. But that alleviated some of the problems. And in some cases, too, they've divvied up responsibilities to kind of separate, to get rid of that overlap. So, for instance, with the two navies, the IRGC Navy has taken responsibility for the inside of the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, and the regular Navy has taken responsibility for outside of the Persian Gulf. So techniques and approaches like that have alleviated some of the problems, some of the coordination problems between the two services. But they certainly do still exist to this day. It's never a good recipe to have multiple units reporting up different chains of command operating in the same area. But the Iranians are taking steps to alleviate some of those problems.
And you mentioned earlier that it's the supreme leader who has the say with the military and not the president. How does that work? And does the president interact with the supreme leader on certain decisions when it comes to military operations? Or is this something that the two of them are completely separate on?
He does interact with the supreme leader on national security issues, principally through the Supreme National Security Council. This is a body that was established to coordinate national security issues in Iran. It's a little bit like our National Security Council. And there are various statutory members of this body. The president is one of the statutory members. However, he doesn't exert a lot of influence over military policy. The president primarily weighs in on budgetary issues, as well as the parliament also weighs in on budgetary issues. So when it comes to allocating resources, the president gets some say over that. But on the detailed day-to-day operations of the military, the president really doesn't have a lot to say. It really comes down to the supreme leader and then the military chain of command under him.
So building off of that last question, how would you say domestic political leaders and then foreign proxies influence operational planning and decision-making within the different Iranian military branches?
I would say that at a strategic level, in terms of foreign policy direction and broad national security issues, domestic politicians in Iran do have some influence over Iran's policies. But when it gets to the operational level, the influence of domestic political actors is very limited. It's really restricted to the supreme leader, the supreme leader's office, his key advisors. He has several advisors who advise him on military and national security issues, and then the military chain of command under him. There is a parliamentary committee, National Security and Foreign Policy Committee, that addresses mainly budgetary issues and broad policy issues. So there's a little bit of influence there. That being said, the Iranian military and the armed forces in general in Iran do care about public perception and how they're perceived in the eyes of the public. We certainly saw this in how they stage-managed funerals of several of the IRGC members who were killed in Syria, for instance. So they're concerned about the public, but it's not something that domestic politicians have a lot of influence over. Proxies, I'd say much more so. Iran's armed forces, Iran manages its proxy relationships with the Quds Force, which is a branch of the IRGC. Many of these relationships go back decades. In fact, several of them you could say were established before even the Islamic Republic came into existence, particularly in Lebanon. So these relationships are longstanding, and there's a lot of give and take in these relationships. You know, but we tend to use the term proxies because we don't have a better term, but it's not really the best way to address it. It's more of a kind of a give and take relationship between close allies that see eye to eye on regional events and often also in terms of their ideology and their religious viewpoints. So with these proxies, when, for instance, the Quds Force is operating in Iraq or in Syria, it will certainly take into account its relationships with these proxies and what they are telling the Iranians they should be doing. Oftentimes, the Iranians will defer, for instance, to Hezbollah in Lebanon and in Syria, or to Asad Bahul Haq in Iraq, or Qatab Hezbollah. So it is very much a give-and-take relationship.
Very interesting. And as most of us know, Iran has been hammered by sanctions for a number of years now. And looking back on other countries that have had sanctions imposed on them, sanctions maybe don't always affect the people that we are hoping they'll affect. So my question is, have sanctions at all affected the military branches of the Iranian military force?
They have, but not in the way that we might assume. So Iran's armed forces have largely maintained their level of spending through the sanctions period. It's fluctuated a little bit, but it's roughly about $13 billion per SIPRI, an organization in Sweden that tracks these things. It's probably a little bit higher than that unofficially, because there's also unofficial spending that doesn't get taken into account publicly in Iran. But generally speaking, they've maintained their budgets and they've maintained operations through the worst period of sanctions. The bigger issue is more access to technology. For a long time, Iran's been prohibited from acquiring offensive military technology per the nuclear sanctions on the open market. This has meant that Iran's armed forces have essentially had to make do with less. And it's also meant that they've ended up stressing self-sufficiency. That's a big part of the Iranian military ethos. The term khod kefai, or self-sufficiency, appears everywhere in military publications. So the Iranians have been designing their own military hardware. In some cases, they've been very successful. So for instance, they designed their own anti-ship cruise missiles, which are basically based on Chinese models, but they're now being produced in Iran. They've also had some less successful attempts. They've had, for instance, they have an aircraft that was designed on a U.S. airframe from the 1970s that called the Sa'ik, which never really worked out for them. So they've had mixed success, but they have gotten very adept at building their own hardware and their own equipment. And this is not something you really see in the developing world that much, and particularly not in the Middle East. So it's, in that sense, sanctions have been helpful to them in a way. Now, the critical issue coming up is that per the nuclear agreement and the associated, there's a UN resolution that accompanies a nuclear agreement, UN Security Council Resolution 2231, the Iranians will be able to acquire conventional military hardware on the open market starting in 2020. And that's coming up. So there's already been press reports of Iranian officials going back and forth to Moscow and Beijing to discuss some of the hardware that they'd like to acquire. When they do this, it'll certainly improve their capabilities, because the stuff that they're talking about is high-end stuff. It's from the Russians, for instance, they're talking about the Bastion Coastal Defense Cruise Missile System, which is a very capable system. They're also talking about Su-30 aircraft, T-72 tanks, so some high-technology stuff. So to make a long story short, sanctions have affected the Iranian military, but not so much in terms of overall expenditures, more in terms of the technology that they've been able or haven't been able to acquire on the open market.
With not being able to acquire certain technology and also looking at the chilly environment that Iran is in within the international community, how have cyber operations become a part of the Iranian military policy and strategy with the greater world.
Cyber operations are interesting. It really fits with the IRGC, particularly with their ethos of an emphasis on asymmetry. So I think for the Iranians, they've generally invested in military capabilities where they get the most bang for the buck. And cyber is a place where there's a low barrier to entry. Anybody can invest in cyber capabilities. It's low cost. And the Iranians also have a highly educated population, particularly in hard sciences, things like physics, mathematics, and computer science. So they have a lot of students who are underemployed. It doesn't take much to invest in these areas. It's not like you need to acquire these capabilities from abroad. It's just a natural fit for them. And it's something that, you know, generally speaking, the West is very vulnerable in. I mean, in cyber terms, it takes a lot for us to protect all of our infrastructure on the cyber side. In the Iranian case, the vulnerabilities aren't as extreme.
And when did they first adopt some of these cyber technologies and different ways of using cyber methods?
Well, they were relative latecomers to the whole cyber bandwagon. It was really post-2000 that they started to invest in this area. Their efforts really took off after Stuxnet and Flame, the two reported attacks on Iran's nuclear program. After that, they set up the Supreme Council on Cyberspace, which is it's focused on defensive cyber, protecting Iranian cyber infrastructure, and also controlling the information flow into Iran. This is something that the regime is very concerned about, which is access to foreign information and information flow in and out of Iran. So they've set up a Supreme Council to coordinate cyber issues between the different agencies in Iran, and they've also developed fairly potent offensive cyber capabilities.
And what have been some of their greatest achievements? Maybe we could call them that.
Yeah. achievements. Well, their offensive cyber operations tend to get the most attention in the press. So these have involved, they're mostly low-level things, DDoS attacks, denial-of-service attacks. So they've conducted attacks on Saudi Aramco and Qatari Rosgas. They've done denial-of-service attacks on U.S. banks. A famous incident was they basically took down the Sands Casino in Las Vegas because they had a beef essentially with the owner, Sheldon Adelson. I think their most successful example in use of offensive cyber, this is really sort of prepping the cyber environment. They had a presence on the U.S. Navy unclassified system. This was reported widely back in 2013. And from all accounts, this is a very sophisticated operation. They had maintained a presence on the Navy's networks for close to a year. And they went undetected for all that time. So this is something that the Navy was obviously very concerned about. Their capabilities aren't, you know, when we're talking offensive cyber, it's not like the Russians or the Chinese, but it's, you know, their capabilities are growing and it's something that they're investing in. And again, it's something that it fits with this ethos of asymmetric warfare. It works well if their principal adversary, as they view it, is a well-developed, a high-end state as opposed to kind of a regional actor. It just makes sense for them to invest in cyber, as it does with a lot of countries that are adversaries or would-be adversaries of the U.S. Defensive cyber is another thing that they've been investing in. I mentioned the Supreme Cyberspace Council. This is largely a coordinating body, but it suggests that they're adopting an interagency approach to defending Iranian networks. There's also a censorship function that council is in charge of. There was talk for a while about setting up an Iranian intranet. This hasn't really gotten off the ground, but it's certainly aspirational for the regime. I think it would love it if it could control all the information flow in and out of the country, but it's not feasible. But that's something that they're concerned about.
I mean, you do hear a lot of accounts of either individuals that have family in Iran that travel there to see them, or people that are in Iran using different methods to not be detected by the government, whether it's VPNs or encrypted messaging apps. So I could see where an intranet might be highly useful to the government.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, you know, the regime is very concerned about that. And the Iranian population is, they're very sophisticated. They have access to outside information. And despite the regime's intensive, I would say, efforts to censor the internet, it hasn't really worked very well. And part of it are these tools that are available to many Iranians. I mean, there are ways to get around censorship. There are anonymizers, VPNs, the different techniques that you mentioned. So it's those techniques are used throughout Iran. They're very well known. So the information flow is very open and free, I would say.
So
despite the government's efforts.
Right. So going back to more on the ground military aspects of Iran and the different branches of the military, I mean, I think two of the main things when people in the West think of Iran, it's of course the nuclear program and then their involvement in Syria, which I'd really like to talk about because they have a heavy hand in Syria. So why don't you give our listeners just a brief intro into why and how Iran is involved in the conflict in Syria?
Sure. Iran has been involved in the conflict in Syria pretty much since the conflict started in the wake of the Arab Spring. Iran, the regime in Iran perceives the government in Damascus as a very close ally. It has ever since the Iran-Iraq War. Those ties actually stretch back to the 1980s. When Iraq invaded Iran, Syria was one of the few countries in the world that openly backed Iran. In fact, it was, with the exception of Libya, it was the only Arab regime that backed Iran. So the Iranians viewed this very positively. The links between those two countries have been extensive. For a long time, Syria has tolerated and in some cases enabled Iran's relationship with Lebanese Hezbollah. And the Iranians have made it very clear that they view the conflict in Syria as an existential conflict. I don't know, I suspect it's not really an existential conflict for them, but they certainly depict it this way. So the Supreme Leader said that, if the Syrian regime goes, we're next, essentially. So we've got to stick with Damascus on this conflict. So Iran's involvement in the beginning was mainly logistical. It appears to have been mostly, just facilitating information sharing, helping Hezbollah logistically. But it expanded around 2013. It became more of 2013-2014 became more military, direct military in nature. And right now, the Quds Force is leading most of its activities in that country. It's working with Shia militia on the ground. It's working with Hezbollah. And it's also established a relationship with Pakistani and Afghan Shia brigades that are being funneled through Iran to support the regime in Syria.
In your knowledge and your background with Iranian studies, do you detect any influences with the strategies that Iranian branches, let's put it that way, are using in Syria currently that they might have gained from the Iran-Iraq war? So history helping current situation.
I think the Iran-Iraq war has certainly influenced how Iran's armed forces, their approach to warfare, their tactics, their strategies. It's less so, I think, in the Syrian case. I think if we were looking for a model in Syria, it'd be more the counterinsurgencies that Iran has waged internally in Iran. So there's been an ongoing conflict with portions of Iran's Kurdish population and also portions of Iran's Baluchi population, so the northwest and the southeast. I think some of the lessons that Iran, particularly the IRGC, has learned from those counterinsurgencies, it's also applying in Syria and in Iraq. I mean, for Iran, I think those two conflicts are very much linked, and a victory in one means essentially a victory in the other. So there's certainly lessons they're learning from sharing with the current conflict in Iraq with the conflict in Syria and vice versa.
And you mentioned Iran's relationship with Hezbollah, and of course Hezbollah is greatly involved in what's taking place in the Levant right now. So could we talk a little bit about Iran's relationship with these non-state actors, so Hezbollah, as well as the different Shiite militias that are involved in the conflict?
Sure. The branch of the IRGC is responsible for overseeing relationships with regional proxies. That's the Quds Force. But the Quds Force's entree into the Arab world in particular is somewhat limited. Some of that has to do with language and culture. Some of that has to do with the fact that the unique circumstances of Iran don't always translate well to neighboring countries. So Iran has come to rely heavily on proxies, and in particular Lebanese Hezbollah. That relationship between the Quds Force and Lebanese Hezbollah is kind of their special relationship, in quotes, kind of like the US-UK relationship. It's very close. It's the Quds Force. A lot of the Quds Force senior officers basically got their initial experience by working with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And in many ways, Iran relies on Hezbollah to act as an intermediary between the Quds Force and other proxies in the region. So the interesting thing is, when you're looking at the conflicts in Yemen, you're looking at the conflict in Syria, you'll often see Hezbollah as sort of the intermediary between the Quds Force and those proxies. This is because Hezbollah it has more experience in the region. Ultimately, Hezbollah is... they're Arabs, they speak Arabic, their relationships in some of these countries are much deeper than those of the Quds Force. So it's really a marriage of interest between the Quds Force and Hezbollah.
And you mentioned earlier that the Iranian military is using individuals from not maybe solely Iran, but Afghanistan and different ethnicities that surround Iran, sending them to Syria. And I've seen reports of individuals being approached by different military secret branches, as they call them, and being told they'll be paid money to go and fight for one of the militia groups in Syria. In your knowledge and experience, what have you seen on this topic?
Oh, this is it's an open secret, essentially, that Iran, although the Iranian government denies there's any connection, Iran has been supporting Afghan and Pakistani Shia, mainly Shia, and their efforts inside Syria. And it's been shipping these armed forces under the supervision of Hezbollah and the Quds Force to fight alongside the Syrian regime. I've seen estimates in the press of individual fighters getting paid around $1,500 a month. I think for Afghan and Pakistani Shia, that's a considerable sum. Mm-hmm. They have suffered significant casualties. I think from the Iranian perspective, this was a way of mitigating some of the casualties that their own forces were experiencing. You know, if you can pay others to do your work for you, it's better in this sense. But I think going for the Iranians and for Hezbollah as well, they've been fairly good at taking care of their own and also foreign fighters operating for them, so that even if there is a casualty and the person dies, they take care of the family. They have a fairly active martyrs organization, particularly in Hezbollah. So I'd imagine that the same thing is occurring with the Afghan and Pakistani Shia, that there is kind of a cradle to grave and beyond care essentially for the families. So I think for Afghan and Pakistani Shia, many of whom are mired in poverty and are on the outs in terms of their own countries, this is sort of an attractive prospect. And there's also been press reporting about them being offered citizenship in Iran when they return, or some kind of a green card status. So that's another another selling point, I think, for the Iranians. The level of the support is debated, but it's, you know, it's probably in the thousands. It's significant.
Interesting. And this whole concept of being involved in Syria but not really being involved, I find very strange, since there have been reports of high-ranking Iranian military officials that have been spotted in areas in Syria. One that comes to mind is the Major General Qasem Soleimani, who's the chief of the IRGC, and he was spotted in Hama province in April of 2017, so this year. So how does the Iranian military deal with sightings such as these and this concept of we're involved, but we're not really involved when we all know that they are?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Initially, the Iranian, the government claimed no involvement. It said, we just offer our diplomatic support, but we're not involved militarily. I think they've somewhat relented since then, just because of the press that's been received about the presence of IRGC officials, including high level. I mean, they've lost a couple senior officers, IRGC officers, in Syria. Brigadier General Hamadani was probably the highest ranking one about a year and a half ago. They can't afford to just pretend that didn't happen. But usually their support is discussed as being passive in nature. So they're there to provide assistance. They're there to coordinate. They often don't acknowledge a direct military role. Qasem Soleimani, who you mentioned, is a particularly interesting figure. He's head of the Quds Force. And he had a very private, I mean, he was a very secretive person with virtually no public persona whatsoever up until about 5 or 6 years ago. Since then is, or maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, actually, since then his public presence has ballooned. I mean, he's all over the place. He's been to Moscow. There are photos of him in Iraq. There are photos of him in Syria. So he's all over the place, and he's almost cultivating this image of an Iranian adventurer who's going to save the day for the region Shia and protect the regime. And it's all very stage managed. It's interesting to look at his presence. It's all the photos of him are very glamorous. You can tell that he's got a PR office that's kind of helping him through these efforts and making sure that his photo gets, you know, front and center in the international news sites.
And do you think with this strategy that's going on, do you think he has aspirations of down the line running for a position in the government or something along those lines?
It's funny. There's been some speculation in that regard. He's denied that he wants any political role in the country. But I think he's certainly thinking about his legacy and down the road. I mean, he's been in the Quds Force now since it was set up. He's an Iran-Iraq war veteran. And I think he's kind of eyeing that, you know, his transition to civilian life, which will probably occur at some point in the near future, just because of the time he's been in that position. So I think that's certainly part of it. He's cultivating that legacy right now, but he's doing it, no doubt, with the Supreme Leader's blessing. So I think the regime's calculated that it has something to gain by advertising his presence. Otherwise, it wouldn't be happening. Like I said, for many years, he had no public presence. You couldn't even find a photo of him. Whereas now he's all over the place. And I think that wouldn't be happening purely of his own initiative. That's the regime saying we've got something to gain by advertising his activities and what he's doing in the region.
Interesting. So we have this counterinsurgency campaign. I guess that's the best way we could describe what's going on with the Iranian military's involvement in Syria. Has this at all changed the way the military works or optimizes itself as far as previous campaigns in the past and what we're seeing now in Syria? Or is this just a new instance, a new battle that they're forging ahead with?
I think it's certainly shifted the focus somewhat away from conventional operations against a major Western military, which has usually been the primary focus of Iran's armed forces, to more of a counterinsurgency role. I mean, Iran has conducted counterinsurgency operations all along, but they're always kind of a low-level nuisance issue for Iran. They weren't sort of a major campaign. That being said, I don't think that the threat posed by the insurgencies in Syria and in Iraq to Iran has risen to the same level as the way the regime views the West, and particularly the United States. I think for the regime, the biggest threat, the long-term threat, is still the U.S., and that's despite the nuclear agreement. That could change over time. You know, it's still a little bit early to say what the results down the road of the nuclear agreement will be. But for the time being, I don't see the Iranian military investing, you know, entirely in counterinsurgency and doing away with its conventional investments in munitions and its naval forces, things like that. So it's had an effect, but I don't think it's an overwhelming effect.
And you mentioned the word investing, and that's something that I think would be a great question. So Iran's military involvement in Syria, do we know financially what that's cost the regime? And also, do we have a number of lives lost? I know you said that they are using individuals that are from other regions so that it cuts down on, I hate to say it, the body count. But do we have any numbers with the cost Syria is putting on Iran?
It's tough to get these. The actual financial cost is very tough to get. I don't think there's an accurate number is very easy to come by in that regard. In terms of the casualty count, that's a little easier to estimate just because a lot of the funerals are publicized. So we have access to how often these funerals take place and where inside Iran. The estimates I've seen from Western agencies that have analyzed this or Western think tanks, they tend to sort of figure in around 300 Iranian personnel so far that have been killed. It could possibly be a little bit more. That's significant, and the regime's certainly sensitive to the casualties it's suffering in Syria, but it's not overwhelming. I mean, you compare it to the Iran-Iraq war, Iran lost upwards of 500,000, you know, between 500,000 and 1,000,000. So that's, you know, 300, 500, these aren't huge numbers for the Iranians. I think one of the things that if you look at the casualty figures, it's very interesting. You see a lot of senior officers. So you look at the mix, it's you would expect, you know, high levels of enlisted and very few officers. And in fact, you have a significant number of senior officers. And I think the reason for that is because Iran decided fairly early on that its best approach to managing the conflict was to rely on proxies. Mm-hmm. And it used officers essentially to manage these proxy relationships. So you have Iranian proxies fighting at the front, either against regime opposition forces or ISIS. And the ones taking the casualties are the officers on the Iranian side. The ones taking the casualties are those officers who manage those proxy forces.
Interesting. In your opinion, what do you think might be Iran's limit in continuing support for this counterinsurgency in Syria as well as supporting Assad? Is there a red line, so to speak?
I think the regime has made it clear that it supports Assad to the hilt, essentially, that it isn't going to sell out Bashar. There's been some talk comparing the Iranian to the Russian approach. I think there was a perception that the Russian approach is a little more nuanced, that the Russians want to maintain a presence in Syria. They certainly support the Syrian government, but you know they're willing to kind of negotiate and whatever they can do to reestablish the regime in a stable sense. I think in the Iranian case, it's a little less nuanced, that it's essentially that the Iranians are there to support the regime to the hilt. And you know, while they'll talk to opposition figures, and there's been some low-level dialogue between the Iranians and the opposition, they certainly don't want to broach the possibility of any threat to Bashar's position in the regime. They have a very close relationship with Bashar and his family, and I don't see any sense that there's any daylight between the Iranian regime and the Syrian regime in that regard.
And in your opinion, if things settle down in Syria and Iraq, which personally I highly doubt that's going to be anytime soon, but if they were to, do you think Iran would still have a hand in the region?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's really what's driving Iran's interest in this regard, is Iran views itself as a regional power, if not the preeminent regional power from Iran's perspective, and it views that it needs to, for its own defense and for its own protection of its own regime, it needs to have play a significant role in the region. And that's in neighboring countries where it has a lot of traction. And those countries would be would be Iraq and Syria and Lebanon in particular, but also to a lesser degree in neighboring countries such as Afghanistan, a little bit in Central Asia, a little bit in the Persian Gulf. Notice I use the term Persian. on the Arab side of the Gulf, in countries like Bahrain or Kuwait, where there's a sizable Shia population. So wherever essentially there's a Shia footprint is where Iran's footprint tends to be the strongest in the region. It hasn't made a lot of inroads in predominantly Sunni countries. So, you know, the Iranians were at a fairly early stage involved in the Arab Spring in North Africa. And there was reporting about the Iranians being involved on the ground, but a lot of that involvement never went anywhere. They tended to kind of follow those where there's at least a significant Shia minority. That's where they've kind of made some inroads in the region. And they want to maintain that influence. And I think that's what their goal is in Syria. That's what their goal is in Iraq, is they view themselves as having a legitimate role to play, and they want to maintain their influence and indirectly control the course of events on the ground in those countries.
I do remember in the North Africa instance, a number of years ago, they were discussing creating better relations with Egypt again. And that, as you said, it sort of fizzled out. There wasn't much that happened with that.
Yes. I think they were placing a lot of hope on the previous Egyptian regime. And when that didn't work out, that kind of scuttled those attempts to work with the Egyptians. Now, the Egyptians will still dabble with the Iranians. I think it's, you know, they don't want to write off the Iranians completely, but Iran's track record in North Africa and in Egypt is very, they just haven't had a lot of success. They haven't made inroads. I think what's got the Gulfies concerned right now is really Iran's influence on their southern flank in Yemen. That's something that not a lot of analysts had predicted. Most people wrote it off and said, well, the Houthis are, you know, they're a different branch of Shiism than the Iranians. They certainly don't see eye to eye with the Iranians ideologically. And yet the Quds Force has managed to establish a presence in Yemen. You know, it's debatable as to why that occurred. But the end result is, you know, Iran is now on the ground in a country where it really didn't have a toehold before. So that's got the Gulfies very concerned right now. The Gulfies, in their approach to managing that problem, haven't always been successful. Sometimes they've been heavy-handed, and that has, in fact, played into Iran's hands. But that's a different story.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that with the Yemen issue, that Iran's involvement in it could be viewed as long-term? So if things settle down in Yemen, which doesn't look like it's going to also happen in the near future. However, if they were to, do you think Iran would keep that hand in the region because it is part of the Gulf and it sends a message to its Gulf neighbors?
I think they would try to. The problem is they don't, unlike places like Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, where there is Iranian influence is longstanding and it runs very deep. Iran's activities in Yemen they're very opportunistic. It's tough to see whether there's any depth there to that relationship. It's probably too early to say. I think the longer that the Quds Force maintains a presence there, the longer that conflict between the Yemeni government, the official government, and the Houthis goes on, and the longer that the Saudis and the Emiratis are involved as well, that'll create depth to that relationship that might outlast the conflict. But for the time being, it's more opportunistic on both sides. So I can't see the Iranians maintaining it. Like if the conflict were solved hypothetically tomorrow, I can't see the Iranians having a large long-term presence in Yemen. But if it doesn't, the longer it doesn't get solved, the more opportunities they have to maintain and deepen those relationships.
Going back to the home front, what do you think is in the future for the various military branches of Iran locally, so within the country?
Well, I think, you know, in the past there was a lot of talk about merging the two forces. There was talk about doing away with the regular military. There was talk about merging the IRGC into the regular military. I think the structure that Iran's armed forces have now is going to be maintained. I don't see major changes to that. I don't think they're going to, I think there's going to be parallel IRGC armed forces and regular armed forces for the foreseeable future. I think where the changes will be is the relative importance attached to each of the branches of the Iranian military might change over time. For instance, for a long time, people had more or less written off the Iranian regular Navy. They said it's not an important branch of the military. It's not going to have any influence. It's really the IRGC Navy. To the extent that the potential for conflict between the U.S. and Iran is reduced, and to the extent that Iran seeks to flex its muscles more on the regional stage, I think you're going to see the regular Iranian Navy playing a more pronounced role in the region and getting more resources that perhaps it hadn't gotten in the past. So, for instance, the Supreme Leader has taken to calling the Iranian regular Navy a strategic force, or the strategic force, the strategic maritime force. So that suggests sort of newfound prominence for the regular Navy. If for instance, the Iran's armed forces do gain access to advanced military technology in the sort of after the 2020 timeframe, that could also add more prominence to Iran's regular armed forces, because most of those high-end items, with some exceptions, but a lot of the high-end items tend to go to the regular military because the regular military is more capable of operating them. So, for instance, there were discussions, Iranian officials in their discussions in Moscow emphasized that they're interested in Su-30 fighters. These are high-tech platforms that the IRGC Air Force probably wouldn't be capable of operating. Those would probably go to the regular Air Force. So that suggests to a certain extent that the regular military is regained or is in the process of regaining a little bit of prominence that it had lost in the intervening decades.
And you're new to CNA, you're new to the Loopcast, excuse me, and we like to give our guests, if there is time permitting, a moment to either touch on something they might not have touched on in the talk or have a final say on something. So I wanted to hand the floor over to you and give you that opportunity.
Well, I would just say, I guess I would say a couple takeaways to take away about the Iranian military is think of it as having, they have two armed forces. Those two armed forces run in parallel. It's a unique situation. There are very few militaries in the world where you have parallel, entire militaries that have parallel services. There are a couple of examples I can take from history, but only a couple. And I would also take away the fact that when we talk about Iran and how command and control works in Iran, that it's really the president. I mean, it's really the supreme leader, not the president, who's the commander in chief of Iran's armed forces. So I think when we look at Iranian presidential elections, which are very important in terms of policy, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Iran's armed forces are going to change drastically depending on who's president in Iran. And the other thing, I guess if I had to add anything else, I'd say look to, excuse me, look to the 2020-2025 timeframe to see an increase in Iranian conventional military capabilities. I think you're going to see some capabilities coming on board that they can acquire from Russia and China that are going to be pretty significant.
Very interesting. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Connell, and hopefully in the future we'll have you back on to discuss one of the projects that you work on at CNA or more about the Iranian military. So I just want to thank you for spending this time with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Thank you.